From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bugsy is just the latest in a long line of films about real-life gangsters. On today's Fresh Air, we compare the movie to the real stories of Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky. We'll talk with Robert Lacey, author of a new biography of Lansky. Also, photographing the dead. It may seem ghoulish now, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a common practice for families to memorialize their dead with pictures of the corpse. We talk with Dr. Stanley Burns, editor of a book of memorial photography. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller, Rush. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is scheduled to leave Tokyo in a few hours to return to Washington, ending his 12-day Asian tour. The president will be bringing back a package of Japanese trade concessions that he says will create American jobs. But as NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Tokyo, American auto executives say the agreements don't go far enough.
Just hours after Mr. Bush announced the agreement, the chairman of both Ford and General Motors held a press conference to say they were unhappy with the package. "We do not have an automotive agreement," said GM Chairman Robert Stempel. Among other things, Japanese automakers have pledged to boost imports of American cars by 20,000 units by the year 1995. Ford Chairman Harold Poling called the numbers almost an embarrassment. The automakers characterized this week's trade talks as merely a beginning, and they said they would be willing to meet again with their Japanese counterparts next month. The president and the prime minister announced a wide-ranging package of concessions aimed at increasing imports of American products to Japan. The action plan includes market-opening measures in 11 areas, including autos, computers, paper, and glass. I'm Deborah Wong in Tokyo.
UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali called today for an urgent ceasefire in Somalia. In a statement, Boutros-Ghali said that the Somali civil war has blocked the delivery of desperately needed food aid and that the fighting has had a disastrous impact on the civilian population. It's been almost a year since Somali dictator Mohamed Siad Barre was deposed by a coalition of rebel groups. Since then, the factions have been fighting among themselves. At least 4,000 people are believed to have been killed and thousands more wounded in the power struggle between interim President Ali Mahdi Mohamed and General Mohamed Farhad Aidid. The United Nations' new peacekeeping operation in Cambodia took a step forward today. A senior UN official was named to head the project, one of the largest in the organization's history. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The head of the project will be Yasushi Akashi of Japan, who now serves as UN Undersecretary General for Disarmament. He also was Undersecretary for Public Information and was Tokyo's UN ambassador in the 1970s. The appointment of Akashi was welcomed by UN officials, who say it will expedite the Cambodian operation. There has been growing anxiety about the disintegration of authority in Cambodia, and some countries have been urging the UN to try to speed up implementation of the plan. The project calls for the UN to oversee a ceasefire in Cambodia and then set up what amounts to an interim government until free elections are held. It is expected to cost more than $1 billion and require the hiring of thousands of people. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Stock prices closed at a record high today on Wall Street, boosted by news of a drop in wholesale prices in 1991. The Dow Industrials gained almost 6 points to close at 3,209. This is NPR. Thousands of people turned out in Tbilisi today to mourn for two men who were shot to death during a rally in support of Georgian President Zviad Gamsakhurdia. Gamsakhurdia is in Armenia, where he fled on Monday after 16 days of fighting between his supporters and opposition groups. One of the last of Chicago's big steel mills is scheduled to close after its parent company and union employees ran out of options for keeping it open. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
USX Corporation, formerly U.S. Steel, announced today that it plans to shut down the sprawling Southworks plant, which it has owned since the turn of the century. Southworks, on the southeastern edge of Chicago, at one time employed 20,000 steel workers who forged beams for high-rise construction. Smaller and more technologically advanced mills now dominate the global steel industry, and these days only about 750 people work at Southworks. Those employees considered buying the plant themselves, but the United Steelworkers abandoned the plan in November after realizing they would have a hard time financing the deal and targeting their products to a changing market. In a statement issued today, USX officials said that most employees will be eligible for pensions and other benefits when the plant closes on or after April 10th of this year. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
There were indications today that a new deadlock may be shaping up in the talks aimed at liberalizing world trade. The biggest stumbling block in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT talks, is a dispute over farm subsidies between the United States and the European Community. The U.S. and other farm exporting nations claim that the EC unfairly subsidizes its farmers and shippers. The head of the GATT, Arthur Dunkel, has introduced a compromise and given the negotiators until Monday to respond. Today, a top EC official told reporters that his side will insist on changes in the provisions of the compromise. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. From James Cagney's classics to The Godfather, some of our best movies have been about gangsters. Movies have created our legends and fantasies about gangster life. The new movie Bugsy tells the story of how Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, with the financial help of Meyer Lansky, created the first luxury hotel casino in the Las Vegas desert. Although Bugsy was rubbed out before his hotel, the Flamingo, became a success, he opened the way for an industry that would eventually make gazillions of dollars. The movie made us curious about the real story of Bugsy, Lansky, and Vegas, so we invited Robert Lacey to talk with us. He's the author of the new book, Little Man, Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life. Lacey is also the author of the bestseller, The Kingdom, about Saudi Arabia, and books about Henry Ford and the British royal family. Let's get started with the movie portrayals of Bugsy and Lansky, as played by Warren Beatty and Ben Kingsley. In this scene, they're in the backseat of a car. The Flamingo has gone way over budget. The hotel and Bugsy are in big financial trouble.
The Flamingo's gonna come in at $6 million, Ben.
Listen, Meyer, anyone who tells you...
Ben, I'm on your side. I'm doing what I can. Stop trying to fool me and stop trying to fool yourself. Look, you need $3 million. If you can come up with $2 million, I can come up with one. Charlie knows nothing about this. This is between you and me. Can you come up with that kind of money?
No problem.
Would you stop that, please? Would you stop with the no problems? Think for a second. What are you going to do to get the money? You always protected me, Benny, when we were kids. You were always behind me. But I can't protect you.
My shares.
What about them?
I own a third of the hotel. I'll sell it.
That's all you've got, Ben. You'll end up with nothing. After all this, nothing.
But the Flamingo will be there. That's not nothing.
One of the things I was really surprised to read in your book was that Ben Siegel did not create the first big hotel casino in Las Vegas. There were already a couple there.
Yes, he went there in the middle of the Second World War to get involved in the bookmaking, which had just become legal in Nevada. And when he got there, there were already two very luxurious hotel resort casinos out on what is called the Strip. I mean, there's this great legend that, which we actually saw in the movie, that he was a sort of modern Mormon who strode out into the desert and said, here will rise shining palaces of chance, these sort of temples of blackjack and that sort of thing. And he dreamt it all up in his head. Well, he learnt it from what he saw, and the evidence shows very clearly that in 1943 he actually tried to buy one of the existing resort casinos that was there, called the Last Frontier. And even his own hotel, the Flamingo, which was so beautifully portrayed in the movie, that wasn't started by him, and it certainly, sadly, was not named after Virginia Hill's legs or anything like that. It was started by another man called Billy Wilkerson, who was quite a significant Beverly Hills figure. He really was involved in the starting of Sunset Strip and The Hollywood Reporter and all sorts of things, and he had the idea of bringing the Beverly Hills glitzy sort of atmosphere out to Las Vegas, which, although luxurious, had a sort of howdy partner, cowboy atmosphere to it. He started the Flamingo. Then he ran out of money, and it was only at that point that Bugsy Siegel came in with his partner's money, and then the rest is sort of history.
It would be interesting to mention, too, here that at the time Bugsy Siegel gets involved with Las Vegas, Mae West and Frank Sinatra were trying to start casinos, too. So it was already in the air by then.
Oh, yes. There's an article in one of the Las Vegas papers for that time saying everybody wants to start a hotel. Yes, Roy Rogers is going to start a dude ranch. The idea that, you know, Bugsy Siegel introduced Hollywood to Las Vegas is sadly not true.
So how did the legend get created that Bugsy Siegel created Las Vegas in a vision?
Well, I think it's hindsight, as with so many things. You know, I don't want to seem a spoilsport here. I mean, Bugsy Siegel was an extraordinary character, and the opening of the Flamingo and all the razzmatazz and disaster surrounding it is very accurately portrayed in the movie, in fact. And I think what really did it was his death. I mean, that spectacular death with which was just as well rendered in newspapers at the time as it was in the movie, with blood and bullets through his head and his eyeball actually getting shot out. I mean, that is one detail that Hollywood got absolutely right. One of his eyeballs was discovered on the other side of the room, on this demure, chintz-covered sofa of his mistress, Virginia Hill. This was headline news all across America in 1947 when it happened. And it was really what put Las Vegas on the popular map, on the map of the popular imagination. You know, what's going on, this city of sin out in the desert? And so in that sense, the spirit of Bugsy is absolutely true to what happened.
You know, in the movie, Bugsy Siegel is portrayed as being occasionally psychotic. He lapses into psychotic frenzies when he's pushed too far or when you make the mistake of calling him Bugsy. From your research in real life, was Bugsy Siegel more consistently crazy than that?
No, I thought that was very accurate, and I thought the way in which right at the beginning of the movie you see his rather more cold-blooded partners, Lucky Luciano and Maya Lansky, quietly waiting in the limo while he goes in to do what they know is violence. They just know he's going to lose his temper, and they're really exploiting his psychosis. From what I can see, that is very much the case. He boasted to the builder, Del Webb, that in the course of his life he'd killed a dozen people. Maya Lansky, talking about him in later years, while denying that he himself, Lansky, had ever killed anybody, said, "But, you know, my friend Benny, well, he knocked off plenty."
How did Ben Siegel get the name of Bugsy, and why did he hate to be called it?
Well, we're not sure. This is buried back in the folklore of the Lower East Side. In the late 1920s, you do see reports in New York papers of something called the Bug and Maya Gang. Not Bugs, in fact, Bug and Maya Gang. And the story is that people said he's crazy as a bed bug, and naturally he himself didn't like this. I mean, there's no doubt at all, we can tell from the photographs, that Benny Siegel was a very fastidious dresser. He loved these wonderful sports jackets with houndstooth check and sharp ties and all that sort of thing. And the idea of being called, being likened to an insect, and being essentially demeaned by the nickname, I can see that it would annoy him. This is another thing I found. You know, we associate all these gangsters with nicknames, you know, Bugs and Fatsy and that sort of thing. But actually, when you look at it, it's the newspapers who coin these phrases and who use them. And, you know, from what one hears on wiretaps or sees in transcripts of wiretaps, the characters themselves don't use this. I think it's another example of the way in which we on the outside embroider all this and sort of putting these desperados in the tradition of Billy the Kid and giving them nicknames.
That's interesting, you know, because I've been wondering why Meyer Lansky never had a nickname that was really used. I mean, the book is called Little Man, and I know he might have been known by that, but it's not what he was popularly known.
No. Well, Meyer Lansky was very different from Ben Siegel. And here again, I thought that Ben Kingsley's depiction of Lansky in the movie was brilliant. I mean, I was wondering how Gandhi was going to play Meyer Lansky. And I just thought it was superb. I mean, you got the fine combination of the loyalty and affection that he obviously felt for his mad friend. And they suggest a reason for it, that when they were kids, Benny had protected him, and that's quite a plausible sort of supposition, combined with this hard head for figures and the ability to, you know, keep everything his head and be the detached businessman. And it was because, of course, he was the detached businessman that Lansky's outlived all the others.
I have to tell you, I'm really partial to Lee Strasberg's performance as Hyman Roth, a character based on Meyer Lansky in Godfather 2. How would you compare those two interpretations of Meyer Lansky?
Well, once again, I think the spirit of Lee Strasberg's depiction of Hyman Roth in Godfather 2 is superb, and one or two details are just absolutely spot on. If you remember at the beginning, and I hope to goodness there are people listening who've watched all these gangster movies and know what we're talking about, but in The Godfather 2, which must, I think, be rated one of the best sequel movies ever, I mean, in a way it outclasses the original, you see Michael Corleone, Al Pacino, driving to this seedy little bungalow in the suburbs of North Miami, on sort of backing onto a brown canal like millions of others. And that is exactly the sort of place that Meyer Lansky lived in. And the again, I thought Strasberg was good in that he captured the humanity of the man. I mean, this was one of the reasons he lived so long and he achieved the great reputation he did. He was somebody that in that very dangerous world, everybody trusted. But then again, you know, there are total acts of fiction. The way Hyman Roth ends up in The Godfather 2 is a strange sort of mixture with JFK. He comes back to Miami Airport, having been to Israel and being thrown out. And a Jack Ruby character comes up through the crowd and shoots him dead. Well, in reality, he just complained about his ulcers, and the FBI were waiting for him and gave him an aspirin, and he went off to be booked and indicted.
I have another question about the difference between Strasberg's performance and Ben Kingsley's performance as Meyer Lansky. Strasberg plays the character as much more Jewish than Ben Kingsley does. Which was closer to the way Strasberg was?
Well,
the way Lansky was.
I don't blame you getting confused. I mean, you know, one starts talking about, you know, Michael Corleone, and then it's Al Pacino, and I find this mingling wonderful, the essence of it all. Towards the end of his life, Meyer Lansky became, it might sound paradoxical to say this, very intensely Jewish, and inasmuch as Strasberg portrayed a later stage of Lansky's life, I don't know if he did it consciously or deliberately, it's probably fairly accurate. What happened in between those two eras, I mean, we see when Lansky, who was born in Eastern Europe, came to America, he sort of abandoned his Jewishness. He had disputes with his father over it. It was as if sticking to the old ways, going to shul, observing the Sabbath were not part of being an American. And he turned his back on it. He had Christmas trees at home. He had bacon in the house. He wouldn't send his children to be educated for their bar mitzvah. And as I say, he turned his back on it. And then really it was after the Flamingo, and just in these years when Israel became independent, that Lansky started to think again about his Jewish identity. He was invited and asked for help smuggling arms to the various groups fighting on behalf of Israel in Palestine. And, of course, you know, the simple business of Jews fighting appealed to him. I mean, he was a tough Jew all his life, and he could identify with what the Israelis were doing.
Let's hear some of Lee Strasberg's portrayal of Meyer Lansky in Godfather 2. He's talking about his dreams for building up his gambling business in Cuba.
I could only live to see it, to be there with you. What I wouldn't give for 20 more years. Here we are, protected. Free to make our profits without Kefauver over the damn Justice Department and the FBI. 90 miles away, partnership with a friendly government.
90 miles? It's nothing.
Just one small step, looking for a man that wants to be president of the United States and having the cash to make it possible. Michael?
We're bigger than U.S. Steel.
We'll talk more about the real Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Robert Lacey, author of the new book *Little Man: Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life*. What were Meyer Lansky's rules of business? You know, he was known as someone who was more involved with the business end of the mob rather than the physically violent part.
That's
which
right.
Which isn't to say he wasn't behind it, but I mean he wasn't the strongman kind of guy.
He started off as a young tough, as all gangsters do, and he worked as a starker, strong arm man, protecting crap games, getting involved in union disputes. He always used to say, you know, I only ever beat up the blacklegs, the scabs. I never, I was always on the workers' side. But, you know, he did come from a violent background, but he very soon saw that if he was to survive and if he was to make any money, he had to disassociate himself from that. He had to stand back. And he became the brains of the various syndicates he was involved in, the accountant, if you like. And he brought to this two particular gifts. I mean, one was a mastery of figures. In all his life, he only spent a couple of months in jail in Saratoga on a gaming conviction. And I went to Saratoga. I found the man who was in jail with him. And he said that, you know, he and Meyer spent their days in jail doing sums. And I said, well, what do you mean sums? And he said, well, I would write down blocks of digits, 8 or 9 by 8 or 9, and Meyer would run his finger up and down, just like a calculator, and reel off the answer. And I'd say, you know, I think you got it wrong. And Meyer would say, no, you check it. And he'd always had it right. And of course, in that business, the ability to keep the figures in your head, not to have anything on paper, is very important. And the other thing Lansky brought to crime, and this may sound paradoxical, was a strange sort of honesty. Gangsters are businessmen in their peculiar way, in their sort of parody of the businessman. They're entrepreneurs, and like every entrepreneur, they live for the dividend. And when they get together on a Friday or Saturday to split up the latest racket they've been involved in, someone has to handle the share out. And the trouble is that most crooks are crooks, and the people who do it put a few thousand in their own pocket and then tell some story about a police chief who had to be bought off or whatever. And everybody goes home disappointed and not quite getting what they expected. And that, of course, is when the trouble starts, the vendettas, the killings and so on. Now, with Lansky, that never happened because Lansky was not personally a greedy man. He never took too much for himself. So everybody left a share out with Meyer Lansky, knowing the sums were right and the shares were honest. And people came back for more. People liked working with Meyer, and they got more experience and more trust. And so his syndicates grew and developed a reputation. But it was all based on this paradox that at the center of a successful criminal enterprise, you need someone honest.
When Lansky ran gambling casinos in places where it was legal to gamble, what was the illegal part? Where did the swindle take place?
Well, the only swindle, I suppose, took place against the state law. Lansky was a bootlegger all through Prohibition, and then after the creation of Las Vegas in the late 40s, he got involved there and in Cuba. People forget that between bootlegging and Las Vegas, the speakeasies and the casinos, there was a strange sort of era of illegal gambling, which actually flourished openly all over America, outside the major cities. They were called carpet joints because they were like the old-fashioned sawdust joints, but they were a bit classier. They were roadhouses. They took advantage of the motor age, and people would drive out of the city. In New York, you drive over the George Washington Bridge, and there on your right Just as you entered New Jersey, you'd see something called Ben Marden's Riviera, which was a very glitzy nightclub, and the roof opened to the stars, and people danced out there on summer nights, and you got wonderful food and great entertainers. I mean, the great show people of the age, because there was no television and no Las Vegas for them in those days. Sophie Tucker and the big bands, and of course that was the world in which Frank Sinatra got his start. And at the back, there was a room with gambling in it. And these places flourished in Saratoga in the month of August. Down in New Orleans, in Jefferson Parish, was a place called the Beverly Club. Across the river from Cincinnati, these are all in Covington and Newport, Kentucky. Always quite close to major cities where you could take advantage of the population, but in a rural area where you could buy off the local police or the local politicians or whatever. And Lansky built up these carpet joints down in Broward County, Florida. That's why I came down here to live. Miami Beach in the 30s and 40s was the premier resort. I mean, just about really the only resort on the East Coast apart from the New Jersey resorts of Atlantic City. People came down here in the winter. And if you wanted gambling, you'd drive north of Dade County to the county line. And as you came up to Broward County, you'd see the lights flashing. And there were Meyer Lansky's roadhouses, the Plantation and the Colonial Inn and La Boheme and horse parlors, the sort of thing people may be familiar with from The Sting, which you know, where the whole denouement takes place in that movie. Well, there really were horse parlors, and in places like this, they were just set up at the side of the road. And in Broward County, Lansky paid off the local sheriff, a man called Walter Clark, and the sheriff's brother turned up at midnight with an armored car and some county police, and would escort the takings of the casinos to the local bank. And so it was all in these areas were called wide open. Everybody knew it shouldn't happen, but it did.
One of the focal points of gangster lore is the relationship between Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky. Was it unusual for someone Jewish like Meyer Lansky and someone Italian like Lucky Luciano to have a collaborative relationship together?
I don't think it was. I mean, there was a movie last year called Mobsters, which treated the coming together of the young Italians and the young Jews as if it was a sort of peace in the Middle East. In fact, they had a lot in common. They were both new immigrant groups. They were living side by side. They had, in fact, much more in common against the WASP establishment and against the Irish than there was to divide them. And, the common picture of organized crime in America is an Italian one. But if you were to look at it in the early 1920s, you would have said it was a Jewish one. I mean, the great boss, crime boss of New York, was Arnold Rothstein, the notorious figure involved in the Fixing of the World series. There were people like Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Waxy Gordon. Dutch Schultz, in fact, was not Jewish, although people think he was. Arthur Flagenheimer, he was German and not German Jewish. And these Jewish gangsters were not just brains like Lansky and money men. I mean, they were tough. They were tough like Bugsy Siegel. And the most notorious bunch of all, which were called Murder Incorporated by the newspapers, were run by Lepke Buchalter and Mendy Weiss. And they were Jewish hitmen. And I was told by cops and people who remember those days in New York that in the time of the Italian gang wars, in 1929, 1930, that the Italians would actually enlist Jews to do the killing. And so the modern stereotypes of all gangsters being Italian certainly wasn't the case back in the heyday of the gangster.
Robert Lacey is the author of Little Man, Meyer Lansky and the Gangster Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today there is a taboo against taking pictures of the dead, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a popular way for families to memorialize their dead. Stanley Burns has an archive of medical photography, and he's edited a book of memorial photography. Coming up, Pictures of the Dead. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Rush, starring Jason Patrick and Jennifer Jason Leigh, as a pair of undercover narcotics agents who get in way over their heads. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush leaves Tokyo and heads for home later this evening after a hectic 12-day trip to the Far East. His visit to Japan left U.S. automakers unhappy with trade promises given them and Japanese charges that the White House is making their country a scapegoat for U.S. economic problems. The chairman of the Ford Motor Company said that the various trade proposals for the U.S. auto industry are not adequate. Meanwhile, a high-ranking Toyota official accused the Big Three automakers of using the U.S. trade deficit as an excuse for their own problems. Don Gagne reports.
Toyota's Bob McCurry, who runs the Japanese auto company's American operation, says tougher import restrictions will not help U.S. automakers compete. In a speech delivered to reporters gathered in Detroit for the North American International Auto Show, McCurry said Toyota and the other Japanese carmakers make easy scapegoats, but adds that much of the problem for the domestic industry has been a willingness to sacrifice long-term gain in favor of near-term profits.
I understand. It's a tough world, and they're going through right now. But it's not Toyota's fault. The Japanese auto industry has taken American ideas, methods, refined them into world's most efficient industrial technology. The U.S. can either match it or pull up their protectionist cover and go back to sleep.
McCurry admitted that Japan does need to open its markets to more foreign products and investment, but ultimately, he says, in order to survive, car makers need to build high-quality vehicles to suit consumer needs. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
In Washington, officials announced today that the FBI plans to move several hundred agents who have been involved in spy-catching efforts to cut down on violent street crime involving gangs. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
With violent crime rising rapidly throughout the country, the Justice Department now estimates violent street gangs have memberships totaling some 300,000. Today, Attorney General William Barr announced the largest reallocation of FBI agents in the history of the Bureau, reassigning some 300 counterintelligence agents to the battle against street gangs in 39 cities. Barr acknowledged that local law enforcement has the primary responsibility for dealing with violent street crime, but he said the federal government has tougher tools to deal with these gangs.
Our message to gangs, gang leaders, and gang members is this: when we throw the federal book at you, it will be a knockout blow. There will be no bail, no probation, no parole, and you will spend a long time in a federal penitentiary.
Attorney General William Barr, I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5.5 points to close at 3,209.53. On volume of some 291 million shares. Trading today was very active. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says that Russia will never give the Black Sea Naval Fleet to Ukraine. Yesterday, thousands of Russians rallied against giving up control of the big ships and submarines. Officials in Ukraine have now postponed for a half year a call that the naval fleet pledge allegiance to their government. The two former Soviet republics have also clashed over land-based troops, and Ukrainian officials recently took control of a key communications facility. Reports indicate that Israel and China will establish full diplomatic relations at the end of this month. An announcement is expected this weekend, less than 2 weeks before a planned visit to China by the Israeli foreign minister. Paul Adams of the BBC reports from Jerusalem.
News that China and Israel are to establish full diplomatic ties for the first time came in the form of a report in the Hong Kong-based Far Eastern Economic Review. It said that Mr. Levy's visit to Peking would clear the way for Chinese participation in the third round of Middle East peace talks, due to take place in Moscow at the end of the month. Israeli officials are refusing to comment, but no one here is in any doubt that the report is true. News of the breakthrough had been expected for some time. In December, the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said he expected the two countries to have diplomatic relations soon. There's also been a flurry of not-so-secret visits both ways.
Paul Adams of the BBC reporting from Jerusalem. In Moscow, the mayor says that he has now accepted resignations from just about all city officials. The vice mayor has been given 2 weeks to form a new city government. Officials said that action by Russian President Boris Yeltsin has already created a new situation in the city, including giving additional powers to the local city government. The new Moscow government is slated to be at least 20% smaller. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's not easy to talk about death in our culture, so the idea of taking memorial photographs of dead loved ones would strike most of us as downright ghoulish. But in the last century, when death at an early age was much more common, postmortem photographs were an important way of remembering the dead for mainstream Protestant America. And in the eyes of my guest, Dr. Stanley Burns, many of these photos were quite moving. Burns is an ophthalmologist who has a medical photography archive and has edited a book of memorial photography called Sleeping Beauty. The title refers to the Victorian concept of death as a restful sleep for a redeemed soul. There are pictures of the dead in coffins, on beds, in rocking chairs, and in the arms of loved ones. Some are beautified with flowers, others are stark. Wealthy people have always been able to afford portraits, but until the 1800s, the working person did not have the means for immortalization.
With the invention of photography in 1839, a process was possible where a person could have the best memorialization conceivable, which was an actual representation of themselves. The problem was, when photography started, not everyone could have their picture taken immediately, and the photographs were expensive. What happened was someone would die before their photograph could get taken. So what resulted was photographer coming and taking a picture of the deceased.
If, say, a parent took a picture of a dead child, what would they like to do with the photograph? Would it be a private memory, or would it be hung on the living room wall?
Well, what started off as private memorialization, became a cultural norm. These pictures were made into lockets. They were made into wall hanging ornaments and put into frames. Most importantly, with the advent of the paper print, many copies were made, and they were sent to all the friends and relatives so that they could see the deceased. It was a normal practice. This was not something that was hidden or shameful, as it is in the 20th century.
Now, the photographs that you've collected in the book are really fascinating. There are several where the mother is posed with the dead child on her lap. And I was saying that it seemed ghoulish to take pictures of the dead, but it seems very much against custom as we know it today to hold somebody dead on your lap and pose with them.
People in the 19th century were quite familiar with death. You died at home, you were taken care of by your loved ones, and you were buried by your loved ones. It was not unusual, therefore, for all members of the family to become extremely familiar with death. Taking a photograph, a mother or father taking a photograph with their dead child, came from a painterly tradition. There was a painterly tradition of the sick child, where there's a famous painting which became known throughout culture, and there were many representations of it, of a mother with her sick child, which was an honoring of motherhood and childhood. When children died, pictures were taken in this style, and oftentimes there's no attempt to show that the child is not dead. There are several pictures in the book where the child obviously has rigor mortis and is garlanded with flowers and other symbols of death.
Yeah, and you'd think that after rigor mortis had set in that the child wouldn't be sitting on the mother's lap, but that's how some of the poses are. Were there no taboos about how much time could have elapsed before a photo was taken?
Well, ideally would be done as soon as possible because people were usually buried promptly. But there is one photograph in the book of a mother who was attached to her daughter that would not let her be buried, and the picture was taken 9 days after death. And actually she looks quite well, which is surprising. Most of us today who are not familiar with death are quite surprised with the appearances in these photographs.
Well, you know, you mentioned how the hands are sometimes a giveaway that the photograph is of a dead person. In some of the photos, the hands are tied together.
In the early era of photography, there was no attempt to beautify death of adults. That's why the book's called Sleeping Beauty. It's the story of how we all got to look like Sleeping Beauties. At the beginning of photography, the religious ethic at the time dictated that we were sinners going to hell to meet our maker. We didn't have to be prettified. And there was no attempt to beautify the pictures. For instance, because of rigor mortis, hands were tied. I have some pictures with the coins on the eyelids, with the chin straps, with all the devices that one would associate with death at the time present in the photograph. There would be pictures with blood running from the mouth and nose, and consideration, I didn't put in the more gruesome of those types photograph, but there are quite a few. There was no attempt to beautify death in adults at the early age of photography.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Stanley Burns, and he's edited a book called Sleeping Beauty, Memorial Photography in America. They're photographs from the 19th and early 20th centuries. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Stanley Burns, and he has an archive of artistic and historical medical photos, and his new book of memorial photography comes from the archives and from other places as well. Most of the photographs in your book are photographs that were taken in the home. This was a time when people were prepared for death at home.
Well, the main home in the room, the parlor, was really the death room in the house. And people were used to preparing and taking care of each other. In the 19th century, we died at home, surrounded by our friends and relatives, and it was a completion of life. We were responsible for our loved ones. Friends and relatives came in, washed the body, and took care of it, and were all part of the mourning process.
When somebody died at home, you say that they were prepared for the funeral in the room that was known as the parlor. But once funeral parlors came into being, the name of that room was changed in the house.
That occurred in 1910 with a quick movement of the journalistic pen. Edward Bach, who was editor of the Ladies' Home Journal, had decided that death was not an important issue for the 20th century American. Because of the absolute miracles of conquest of disease, there was a great movement on, and a great understanding that death itself would be conquered in the 20th century. To foster that idea, the dying of death was a common topic of discussion. And Editor Bach dictated that he would not accept the designation parlor for any room in the home that was shown or listed, portrayed in the Ladies' Home Journal, and that to go the exact opposite route, he made up the name living room. And so that when we discuss living room, we're really talking about the death room in our house.
When funeral homes, funeral parlors, were becoming more popular, what happened to the idea of taking pictures of the dead?
The idea of photographing the dead, how shall I say, died with the advent of the loss of death in America. Because of World War I, mourning was abolished, and literally abolished, just almost the same as Edward Bach's swift pen. The Queen in England, looking out over her subjects, because of the tremendous numbers of death in World War I, everyone was wearing mourning clothes. And this was not a good morale booster. So she decreed that mourning clothes would be not required, how shall I say, in society. And they were removed from society.
So yeah. when part of the mourning process died out, sort of the whole idea of
the whole idea
photography?
Of taking photographs. However, because of the shamefulness and taboo of death in the 20th century, people take photographs, but they do not talk about them anymore. As a matter of fact, Ann Landers, in a column, had received a letter someone had sent her a letter about she had received from one of her relatives some postmortem pictures of a relative in a coffin. And Landers did not like the idea. And she printed it. This was her answer. However, within a short time, she received over 1,000 replies to this column and retracted the statement and reprinted some of those letters. And it turns out, as I had predicted in my book, that people are still taking postmortem photographs. It's not part of the cultural norm, but they do it because it's one of the last acts of memorialization. It's not, as I said, widely done, but it's being done, and it is being done more and more as we recognize the need to participate more in the death process.
You know, the early daguerreotype photography was not the easiest or quickest process. It's hardly like having a little, Polaroid at home. What did it entail to have somebody come in and take a photograph of a deceased relative?
Well, it actually was a big deal. The photographer had to bring his entire apparatus. Many of these pictures are extremely beautiful because you had to hold still for a while to take your photograph when you were living. Many pictures of children, especially young children, daguerreotypes, show the child moving. There's a blur in the image. It's hard to get a daguerreotype of a still child that holds still for 20 seconds or more.
Yeah, because the exposure time is so long.
Because exposure time is long. However, with the dead, you don't have to worry about exposure time. You could take your time with lighting, with positioning, and you could shoot as long as you would like with the different lighting effects. So postmortem photographs are artistically very beautiful in many, many cases because of that fact of early photography.
Let me ask you, have you ever done anything like this yourself, or would you ever consider it?
I would consider it, but I haven't done it. I, as most Americans, have lived a good part of my life without having an experience to death. The average 20-year-old person has almost a 98 or more percent chance of not experiencing a death in their family for the next 25 years. There will be no death of children or parents. And so that death in America has become an old age process.
Not completely, especially with an epidemic like AIDS.
Well, that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because the present AIDS epidemic forces us to face death by disease in the prime of life. And This is for the first time in 70 years we see people die prematurely, children before parents.
Do you know if a lot of people who have lost loved ones from AIDS have been taking pictures of the deceased?
Yes, they have. It's a loving act. There's very little you could do for a dying person. And there's very little one can do in our society with the way funerals are done. And the mourning and bereavement process has been shortened so that we don't get much time to really participate in and work out our grief. Taking a photograph allows that participation, and it gives you something positive, something you can keep, something you can hold in your hand. You don't have to put it on your wall, but it's there. One of the research things that I have done is talk to people who have owned photo development places. And the research has shown that whereas people take sex pictures and send them in to be developed, the same number, same percentage of death pictures are apparently running through these development places. So it is being done, it's just not being talked about. Death is our 20th century taboo and shameful topic, personal, intimate death.
Do you find it kind of paradoxical that at this time where, as you say, we've become so kind of out of touch with death, it's taken care of by the professionals, yet death is so much more explicitly shown in fiction, you know, in the literature we read, on in the movies that we see?
Well, violent death is, and war death is part of our daily diet. I can shoot the engineer here, say, and
hey,
and I, no matter how horrible a job I did, they'd have his picture in the paper tomorrow, and they say, hey, look what he did, and we could show it around, and we can have it over breakfast and everything else. However, if he died right now and had a heart attack, and I took a very beautiful, loving post-mortem photograph of him after he was dead, and I showed it around, people say, what are you showing me this for? It's a difference in what our diet is. We do not deal with personal death in this century. If your mother dies, a relative dies, I'm sorry to hear about it. I hope you can make it to work day after tomorrow. The violent death, crime is expected. The natural personal death is not. And I'm really trying to make that part of life.
Well, Dr. Stanley Burns, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Stanley Burns edited the book Sleeping Beauty, Memorial Photography in America. It's published by 12 Trees Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you doing a wrap-up on the president's trip to Japan?
We are, Terry, on the results of the meetings, the agreements, and some analysis about what it means. And the president's collapse last night has inspired us to have a little bit of a discussion about the flu. Rene Montaigne has a piece on Zaire, a long and serious consideration of a country which appears headed directly for ruin. And we have a piece on a bias survey which discovered that 61% of the American people know nothing about Wizian Americans.
Wizian?
Right.
Okay, you're not going to tell me. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Coming off their Academy Award for Driving Miss Daisy, producers Richard and Lily Zanuck paid a whopping $1 million for the rights to film Kim Wozencraft's autobiographical novel, Rush. They could have gone with big-name stars and a big-name director. Instead, they went with relative newcomers, with Lily Zenick making her directorial debut. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us how it all turned out.
How it turned out is powerful. Bleak, despairing, at times painful to watch, but undeniably powerful. In the interests of full disclosure, I should point out that Lily Zenick is a friend of mine. But if she weren't, I would still be hailing a remarkable new director, one who's a little hampered by the nature of the material she's using, but one who seems to have been born with confidence and style, and above all a willingness to look the truth squarely in the eye, no matter how much it hurts. The painful truth in Rush is simply this. Police who do undercover narcotics work aren't supposed to turn into drug addicts, but they often do. When you're face-to-face with a heavily armed, wildly paranoid drug dealer, and you're pretending to be a buyer, you don't fake it. You smoke, sniff, and when you have to, inject the drug you're buying. And if you do that day in and day out, you're likely to get hooked. For Jim Raynor, played by Jason Patrick, it's a job he takes a macho pride in. For his green new partner, Kristen Cates, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, it's the challenge of a lifetime. But first, Raynor has to explain the ropes.
We buy drugs. Larry died, gives us the money. And he's the only one we ever talk to in the whole department. Everybody else, we're junkies. What that means is if we get into something, we ain't gonna call in no officer assist to get out. Our officer assist is each other. So what I'm saying is when you come into this, it can't be halfway.
Oh, I didn't think it was.
You know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Gotta be able to lie better than that.
The more extreme a role gets, the better Jennifer Jason Leigh is at playing it, which is to say she improves throughout the movie as Kristen goes from being a sweet, boring girl next door to being madly in love, hideously strung out, and finally much sadder and much wiser, as tough in her way as her mentor, Raynor. As for Jason Patrick, well, he may be the most underrated young actor working in movies today. For all his burning good looks, what's most exciting about Patrick is his intensity. In an era of Kevin Costner blandness, he exudes the kind of magnetic danger we haven't seen in years. Rush is full of marvelous actors, from Max Perlick, as the winsome small-time dealer forced to turn informer, to Greg Allman, who gives an amazing, almost wordless performance as the crime kingpin no one ever seems to catch in the act. Rush is set in a small Texas town during the 70s, and it has atmosphere to burn. The movie feels gritty and authentic, and at times stomach-churning, and yet the camera work is always graceful, always beautifully thought out. At times the characters may seem too remote, and their experiences too joyless, but to have altered that would have been to alter the truth of addiction. Addicts are remote and self-involved and not terribly fun to be around, and Rush refuses to sentimentalize them. This movie should lay to rest forever the myth that women directors are best at making weepies in light comedies. There aren't many men out there who could have taken on this material and come back with such strong stuff.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tui, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise of neo-authoritarianism, government that combines communism's authoritarian control over its people with capitalism's free market economy. Stan Sesser says Singapore is perhaps the best example of this new style. We'll talk with Sesser, who covers Asia for The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.